KB Digital Radio, it's time for an act of worship, led by Canon Stephen Shipley. Here on FM, the Book of the Week, Stories in the Stars by Susanna Hislop, reflects on our relationship with the night sky. We look up, we notice patterns, we try to make sense of them, from the gods of the ancient world to the instruments of 18th century science. Every constellation tells a story.
Canis Major. This is the big dog, the leader of the pack, with a plethora of tall tales to suit his stature. The proud hound that the ancient Mesopotamians saw tearing across the heavens in pursuit of a terrified hare shivering under a giant huntsman's feet. To the Greeks, this huntsman was Orion, and his dog Canis Major was usually paired together with a playful companion, Canis Minor. Sirius, the constellation's brightest star, is the dog star. Named for its searing, scorching light, it is the brightest star in our sky. Outshone only by a planet, it can be found in the earliest astronomical records. Known in Egypt as Sopdet, its heliacal rising, when, after a time of absence, it first becomes visible just before sunrise, marked the beginning of their Sothic year, just before the annual flooding of the Nile and the summer solstice, when the sun was at its very hottest. The Greeks and the Romans absorbed this idea of a period of stifling dog days, when, as Virgil wrote, the sweltering dog star splits the cracked fields with thirst. Sirius's heat was imagined to combine with that of the sun, emitting strange, malign emanations that would send men starstruck and dogs berserk and foaming at the mouth. The ancient Chinese also saw a rabid dog in Sirius. Tian Lang, the celestial jackal, was a wolf of the East who ravaged farmyards and had to be hunted down by the celestial hunting dog, Tian Kao, which was also seen in the stars of Canis Major. At the same time, Alaskan Inuits called Sirius Moon Dog. The Seri Indians of Mexico and the Tohono O'odham of Arizona saw it as a dog chasing mountain sheep. While Inuits from the Coppermine area in the Northwest Territories saw its scintillating flame as a red fox and a white fox fighting each other. Tennyson, too, saw a skirmish in its lights. The fiery Sirius alters hue and bickers into red and emerald. In 1862, the American telescope builder Alvin G. Clark discovered that Sirius is in fact a binary star, and that it does indeed have a faint but faithful companion, a tiny white dwarf known affectionately as the Pup.
Cepheus, the Ethiopian king. I cannot tell my grief, and yet there you see it, in the cinema of the stars, a shameful family saga played endlessly in the heaven's eternal picture show. I was king of Joppa, husband to the vainglorious Cassiopeia, and father, though I deserve not the name, to the most beautiful of girls, my Andromeda. Nowadays my stars are not so bright, and it will take all of your squinting, brain-squeezing imagination to trace my figure in the sky. I'm never the one anyone remembers in the story, in any case. Unlike my wife, whose five most brilliant stars form a famous W for woman, witch, and what have you. Perhaps I was too weak. It's true that my queen had me wrapped around her little finger, but what a beautiful little finger it was. Yet one day, when Cassiopeia was combing her thick, dark locks, her boasts got out of hand. Looking into the gilt mirror before her, she declared that she was more lovely even than Poseidon's fair daughters, the Nereides, those extraordinarily beautiful water nymphs. The god of the seas was enraged. He struck his trident on the wine-dark waves and unleashed the full power of his fury. First the lands were flooded by the violence of the water he stirred up, and then there arose from the deep the heinous sea monster Cetus. This monster wreaked havoc on my kingdom. I went to the oracle of Ammon to ask how to save my people from its jaws, but the answer broke my heart in twain. I must sacrifice my daughter to this hungry fiend, or let my subjects face its limitless wrath. So I took Andromeda to the water's edge, and I chained my own daughter to a rock. Her terrified screams and thrashing limbs still torture me in my dreams. The monster loomed out of the sea and set its foul sights on my darling girl. Her story, thank Zeus, does not end badly. Journeying home from slaughtering the Gorgon Medusa was Perseus, who overheard her piercing cries and was as entranced by her beauty as I was by her mother's. Promising to slay the monster in return for her hand in marriage, he found a way to outwit it. He hovered above Cetus with the sun behind him, and as the beast lurched towards Perseus's shadow, the man himself thrust his sword into its flesh, rescuing Andromeda and carrying her away on his flying steed, Pegasus. She has not, of course, forgiven her mother or me. My punishment is my grief, and the sky's perpetual reminding me of it. While her mother is condemned to circle the celestial pole, spending part of the year hanging upside down, legs apart, in a vulgar and shameful posture, designed to punish her pride.
Virgo, the maiden. First, there is that awakening deep in the marrow of your winter-shrunk bones, that quality of hope in the light, and then there are daffodils and evenings. Evenings! You'd forgotten that days didn't turn straight into night before you'd even left work. Spring! Spring has sprung! Next, these heart-speeding spring days mellow into early summer, and the whole world hovers on a heady, glorious axis. Things are no longer newborn, but are not yet fully grown. The sun is warm, but the air is still cool. Everywhere is blossom and bloom, and everything is promise, but the crops are not yet cut. Across centuries and continents, humans have known this as the time of the virgin, fertile, plump, and ripe for the plucking. So, of course, this is the season when, if you look up to the stars, you will see one in the sky, holding an ear of wheat or a sheaf of corn, and held aloft in the night sky by angelic wings, is Virgo. The Babylonians called her Ishtar, or Ashtoreth, or Astarte. The Egyptians associated her with Isis, their goddess of magic, motherhood, and fertility. Virgo's lights appear most brightly in the sky just at this heady liminal time of year, when Anglo-Saxon pagans would have been offering coloured eggs to their own goddess of fertility in spring, Istra, placing these painted talismans on graves in a festival of rebirth that gave us the Christian Easter. Although it is the second largest constellation in the sky, Virgo stars are fairly faint. Except, that is, for the brilliant first magnitude Spica, a blue or blue-white lucifer that, as its Latin name tells you, marks the ear of grain she holds in her hand. Desert Arabs sometimes called this lonely-seeming star Azimek, from Al-Simak Al-A'zal, meaning the undefended. It may look solitary to the naked eye, but it is easy to find, especially with the help of the old stargazer's adage, follow the arc of Arcturus and then speed on to Spica. That is to say, trace a line through the handle of the Big Dipper in Ursa Major and continue southwards through Arcturus in Boötes and then down, and you will find a Virginis, or the Virgin Spike, as it is known in Old England. But we are not in Albion. We are in a meadow in Sicily, and Persephone is skimming her fingers over the long grass. Occasionally she picks a flower. Occasionally the breeze catches a strand of her hair. Bending down to smell a narcissus in bloom, she feels the earth crack beneath her feet, and she is sucked all the way to Hades. She doesn't return that evening, or the next, and her mother, Demeter, searches for her furiously, racked by worry. Since Demeter is the goddess of grain, her grief is felt in the fields. The crops wither. She asks the Great Bear if she saw anything in the night, but only the sun god Helios witnessed what happened. When Demeter hears that Hades, the king of the underworld, has stolen his own niece and taken the virgin as his spoil, she fumes her way to Persephone's father Zeus and forces him to rescue her. The cunning Hades, however, now plays a cruel trick. Like all good girls, Persephone knows that if you are ever abducted and taken to the underworld, you must not touch a morsel of food or you can never again reside in the land of the living. And not one crumb has thus far touched the reluctant bride's lips. But as news reaches her and her uncle that she is about to be freed, Hades prepares her a farewell feast. Not when he offers her the finest loaves or the sweetest wine is she tempted, until, finally, he hands her a pomegranate. She can't resist, and has just 6 of its succulent seeds. And with those 6 small transgressions, she casts her fate. She will have to spend 1/3 of every year in the underworld, and as winter comes, the earth will mourn and the crops will die, until she returns each year in the spring.
Coleman Domingo, Paul Copley and Maggie Steed were reading from Stories in the Stars by Susanna Hislop. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. On Women's Hour after the news, as women in their 30s as well as their 20s now out-earn men, what does the new generation of men really think about living with alpha women? And with growing concern about obesity and more people encouraged to do exercise, why isn't more sportswear aimed at larger women? Sheila McLennan asks the questions on Women's Hour in a couple of minutes.
It's an absolute page-turner. Celia DeWolf, the producer of Radio 4's 10-hour adaptation of War and Peace. It's a wonderful romance. It's a wonderful piece of historical storytelling. With Napoleon, played by Simon Russell Beale.
You do fall in love with the characters. I mean, Nikolai and Natasha.
To go to Moscow. I don't want to go anywhere. I want him here.
War and Peace unfolds across New Year's Day on BBC Radio 4 FM from 9 o'clock in the morning and then online for 30 days.